Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the committee members and colleagues who are present this morning. Chair, maybe I need to start by recording the apology of my principal, both the Minister and the Deputy Minister. Chair, would you like to say something to the committee? But what I can indicate to you is that I'm supported by him and as the Minister of the National Department. I am mandated and authorized to take the committee for the presentation. And I'm supported by the two Deputy Director General who are responsible for the entities that we'll be discussing today. And maybe I must just allow themselves to introduce themselves in their area.
Morning, my name is Makhola Makhulu, I'm the ACDG for energy.
Good morning, committee members. My name is Komso Lise, I'm the DG responsible for transport.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. Chair, the presentation was related. We would have liked to set it up so that we can also allow for a more meaningful engagement in terms of conversation. But nevertheless, we understand that the members have the copy and we engage on their copy instead of the electronic version. And yeah, I think maybe to contextualize this presentation, what we thought we would do, and we can just shoot straight into slide number two, we wanted to share probably the policy because when we are talking build program, we decided as a department that let's not limit it to one entity, because most of the time when we're taking the build program within the department of the market, most people associate the care with a company. So let's expand it into the portfolio and talk about the build program, including Transnet as well. So we take you through the policy context and what influence is the build program in terms of the portfolio, and then we'll go into the specific program, Transnet and Eskom. If we can shift it to slide number 3J, as a shareholder department, we operate within a number of policies, and this precedes 85, our National Economic Development Priority. You are aware that now we are aligning ourselves as the government department and the entity with the National Development Plan, as well as the New Growth Act, as well as the Industrial Co-Selection Plan. There are other policies that are routine, that you are policies that are around the areas of beneficiation and poverty. But because of the purpose of what is being asked, we zoom into these three policies because we see as we go into the presentation that they also talk to the issues of youth development, localization, and beneficiation. I won't rehash what is contained in the respective policies. Safe to say that we've decided to break down each policy in terms of the strategic focus for the relevance of the department and its portfolio, and then the outcomes or the desired outcomes keep from our perspective. If you look at the NDP, it defines the vision of the country until 2030. So it's a more of a long-term plan, and that's very ambitious targets for the country. So what we did as the department, we then zoomed into those aspects of the NDP that are relevant for ourselves, and we took out the role of the state, including the state-owned companies, to drive the developmental agenda is a key critical factor for us to be able to focus the state-owned companies. And if you look at the outcome that we have identified, we say because there's a need to increase investment expenditure to 30% of the GDP, that percent of that is economic growth, which we know now that the economists are saying actually is concerned by the Minister of Finance and his budget vote that actually the 5% is now reduced to about 2%. We also saying we want to reduce unemployment and reduce poverty. So out of the National Development Plan, we're saying that we will use the big program, we will use UNCLED and ESCOM programs to make sure that those outcomes are achieved. In so far as the NGP concerns, we looked at the key objectives of the policy, and we said the biggest one is how do you address the structural impediments that have been created by the uneven growth levels. So with that, we say 5 million jobs to be created by 2020, increase labor absorption rate to ensure that we contribute to 60% that is in the global economy. And once again, as we, the team will be going to the details of it, and you'll see where we're plotting this job creation in terms of our regional companies and how then we include this in terms of the shareholder compact so that you can be able to monitor progress and challenges that the state-owned companies face. Lastly, on the industrial policy action plan, we realize that the industrial base of the country has not been doing very well. And again, this is the history of the country when South Africa didn't rely heavily on the economy that was more resource-based. And as a result of that, you had unintended consequences of some sectors of the economy, such as like your manufacturing. So we wanted to invest that trend and ensure that we create industrial base. And we're looking at how then we use our state companies to contribute to what you may call priority sectors, the automotive, clothing and textile, pharmaceutical, metal, etc. So they have been identified by CTI, but then saying there's a role for the own companies through the industrialization and localization to ensure that the procurement processes within the state owned companies contributes towards those objectives. Our desired outcome is that with our participation there will be enhanced competitiveness in the manufacturing sector. And you see that with the progress that we're making around the channel, we're beginning to see the benefits of that, although we still believe that there's more to be done. The development of new industrial capabilities and localization functions in the sector, and I think when Transnet DDG goes into the presentation, you will see how we've been using the procurement of the locomotives to ensure that we develop local content. And of course, if you expand, we believe that if you expand on the employment in the manufacturing sector, so the idea is to move away from concentrating on the mining and develop your manufacturing sector, then you would be able then to see that you don't have reliance in terms of job creation, skill development, mainly based on resource or mining products. And on the slide 4, here is just now to say how did we translate those policies into an action plan for the department. We have the medium-term strategic framework, which is set for a period of 5 years between 2014 and 2019. What we have done as a department, we have taken the MTSF objectives and then plotted them in terms of each state-owned company. And you will see as we go through the presentation again that the specific activities that ESCOM is responsible for to support the MTSF goals as well as the need to throw the call, support the call of the president on the PICD through the strategic program. So what we've done, we've said insofar as state-owned companies are involved in the build program, there are other activities that they must still do in addition to the build program so that then they can contribute to economic growth and also support the MTSF. And I think it's a few chair, we will be also briefing the same committee on our strategic plan and our annual performance plan. And I think we'll go into detail on the MTSF now, zooming into what we will be doing specifically as a department to support this work. The next slide on industrialization and localization, Chair, already discussed the need to follow suppliers. I think the takeaway from the slide is just that our program, the Competitive Supply Development Program, CSDP, is a program that is developed by, initiated by the department, focusing here on the state of companies within our portfolio. We piloted the program through ESCOM Transnet, and with engagement with National Treasury and DTI, there's interest to expand it outside the portfolio, and we think that will also be a positive contribution by the state-owned companies. But I think as we go through the presentation, you'll see the details on skills and job creation as well as transforming becoming the key focus for the competitive supplier development program. We also put this as part of the targeting and monitoring of the progress of state-owned companies. Slide number 9, Chair, just we link this with the request on the basis of continuity. Firstly, to say that it's now a known fact that the investment in the economy by the private sector has not been at an optimal level. And we looked at the rationale and the reason for that as the state. If the state is not able to create and catalyze the environment that is conducive for private sector people, you would have slow investment rates by the private sector. So we said then, how do we catalyze that environment? Our view was the beauty of the game. So you see that when the private sector was not investing heavily after 2008 due to the recession, we pushed, as I say, we pushed the state of companies or the public corporations to invest. And as a result of that, that put strain on the balance and that put strain as well on the share companies. But also to the issue on how do you maintain an appropriate balance between ensuring that there's an infrastructure development and investment in network industries at the same time as you are not creating entities that are a burden to the fiscal. And I think the current electricity challenges and current challenges as well on ports and rail infrastructure are a clear sign that there's not enough infrastructure capacity to drive economic activity. And now we were forced to play catch-up. And in playing catch-up, there's a great deficit on time and the resources. And so we provided short-term challenges of investment to our state-owned companies to address it. And we think that the projected economic growth in the NDP will not be realized if we don't accelerate investment. And the good program by Fastnet and ESCOM is beginning to do that. However, we don't want to create mismessages or a perception that we say the state does not require private sector investment. So what we're saying is that you need a complementary relationship between the private sector and the public sector. And involvement of the private sector in rolling out the infrastructure together with the state-owned companies is going to be important. And I think, again, when you're talking to Transnet, you see how Transnet investment, even outside the country in terms of the region, becomes critical. Then lastly, we say you need innovation funding models for infrastructure development. As I said, because if you don't do that, you're going to create state-owned companies that are existing and that are heavily reliant on the fiscal because they are balance sheet that's destroyed. So with those few slides, okay, I wanted to set the scene for the build program so that you can understand the rationale for using state-owned companies which we call to the economic scope. So I will hand over to DBG Transnet first, DBG Transnet to go through the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, ADG. Thank you, Chester. In terms of Transnet's contribution to the build program, I think we are all aware that translate and Gospel and Magazine strategy to contribute to the growth of the economy. The previous strategy that Transnet had embarked on did focus on investment, but with this one, the investment levels had been greatly accelerated. So what the market demand strategy, which we call MDS, is all about really is about rolling out about 300 billion rand per investment program over a 7-year period. So every 7 years, Transnet budgets to invest about 300 billion rand. And I think we will also see that what this means is that the number keeps on increasing, so it does not become a static plus minus 300 billion. This is meant to expand rail port and pipeline infrastructure, as the ACD has said, to ensure that we have enough capacity in the country to move the freight that we need to move within the country, as well as to export it to other countries. The MDS is also meant to ensure that Transnet maintains a continued financial stability and financial position. And through the investment, we're looking obviously to also strengthen the balance sheet of the company so that it is able to generate the revenue that is required for future demand as well. The MDS is also meant to significantly improve productivity and operational efficiency through the various investments that are made in the infrastructure as well as the release of the equipment that is required to move freight. The MDS aims to also shift traffic from road to rail and thereby reducing the cost of doing business and carbon emissions. And I think if I could pause a little bit on this, what this really means is it does not necessarily mean that a price of a service will necessarily decrease, but what it means is that through the efficiencies and the increased productivity that Transnet will be able to gain through the investment, the logistical supply chain will actually become more efficient and bear more benefits for the country, and thereby the cost of doing business will actually be reduced due to the increased efficiency. The MDS will also enable economic growth and obviously contribute to job creation, skill development, localization, and environmental transformation. The next slide just shows the 7-year capital investment plan, which is currently sitting around 336.6 billion. And this amount is actually divided into all of the divisions of Transnet. We will see that the bulk of this amount is actually going to Transnet Freight. The reason why is because the bulk of Transnet infrastructure is actually within the rail system. All of the rail tracks that span across the whole country, the locomotives, the wagons that are used to move freight, actually take up the majority of Transnet assets. And due to the level of underinvestment that has been experienced throughout these assets throughout the years, the bulk of this funding has to go to the city to ensure that we improve the productivity of those assets and contribute more for the economy. The rest of the 326 billion goes to Transnet Engineering, which is responsible for building and maintaining the rolling stock that Transnet uses and the other rail operators use as well in the country. About 52.7 billion, which is about 16%, goes to the Transnet National Port Authority, responsible for the port infrastructure and is the landlord of all of the ports in the country. And then 15%, which is about 51.3 billion, is allocated to Transnet port terminals. 4%, which is about 13.9 billion, is also allocated to Transnet pipeline. The next slide just highlights the key infrastructure projects that Transnet has engaged in. I think we are all aware of the six projects, and I'll just quickly go through what each project entails. Step one is about developing a whole corridor through the Waterberg coal fields, and in this case, Transnet is looking to increase export coal rail capacity from the area through to the Port of Richards Bay to about 81 million tons per year. Step two is the National Multi-Product Pipeline, which is a strategic investment to transport petroleum products to the inland market over the network of about 555 kilometers. This project is currently behind schedule by about 5 years from the time that it was initially intended to be completed, which is around 2010. SIP 2, also Transnet will be expanding and establishing a new inland port terminal. So SIP 2 actually entails all those projects that are between Johannesburg and Durban. So Transnet will also be expanding and establishing a new inland port terminal that is situated in Kazemi and Fekaren, Pyramid South and Tango Springs. And then another one that falls within SIP 2 is the Durban Container Capacity Creation, which involves the expansion of Pier 1 and Pier 2, as well as the development of the Durban River Port. SIP 3 is about the relocation of the export manganese terminal from the Port of PE to the Port of Moha, as well as the increase of capacity to 16 million tons per annum. Further, entails the further expansion of the export iron ore channel from the current 60 million tons to 70 million tons, and thereafter there has to be incremental improvements in line with customer demand. And within this project, Transnet will be acquiring rolling stock, about 1,064 locomotives for the general freight business, 95 locomotives as well for general freight business, as well as 60, and about 100 locomotives for the coal business, and wagons to go with those locomotives. And then over and above the big project, there's also the Swaziland Rail Link, which entails the construction of a new rail link line and the reconstruction and upgrade of existing rail links from North A in South Africa through Swaziland in order to move general rail traffic from the export coal line. And then, in general, the general freight business also requires some infrastructure revitalization. As I have mentioned before, we've had underinvestment in the past years, which Transnet needs to catch up on, as well as ensure that we improve the infrastructure to ensure that it is fit for purpose and also is able to cater for capacity ahead of demand. And then I think we were also aware that sometime last year the government initiated Operation Hakisa, which is meant to accelerate investment in various areas, of which for Transnet what is relevant is in the marine sector. Operation Hakisa was an initiative championed by the presidency with the Department of Environmental Affairs in the lead department to stimulate the marine economy. The objective of this initiative is to increase maritime contribution to GDP by approximately 14 to 23 billion by 2019, and also to increase the number of total jobs that are created by about 40,000 to 50,000 by 2019. TNPA is the custodian of marine infrastructure, as I already mentioned. So it has also been identified as a critical role set to implement the initiatives of Operation Hakisa. The key infrastructure projects that TNPA is responsible for are the acceleration of the identified ships and risk retail, as well as the supply-based investment sector for social data. And in this case, what Transnet is looking to do is to research the general maintenance key, as well as the oil and gas supply base there, to also invest in the repair facility at FED 205, as well as the extension of the motorway. Another project has to do with the refurbishment of existing ship repair facilities over the next 5 years, and these are in the Port of Durban, East London, Port Elizabeth, Mossel Bay, and Cape Town. Another project within Operation Pakisa is the dredging at the Port of Richards Bay, and this is meant to accommodate the floating dock. The last one is the refurbishment of the East London Seaway to accommodate a boat building facility. And here, within Operation Pakisa, this is where Transnet is also engaging private sector to ensure that all of these investments, all of the investments that are required for operating Pakisa, can actually fund some collaboration with the private sector. So whereas Operation Pakisa has been, or rather the investments for Operation Pakisa have been provided for in the capital plan for Transnet over the 7 years and beyond, there is some room for private sector participation, whether it be in a form of funding or operation. So Transnet is busy with the private sector in just to also prioritize which project should come first to ensure that the needs of customers are taken into consideration. The job creation that comes as a result of this build program is actually modeled to show the number of jobs that would be created, whether it's induced jobs, direct jobs, or indirect jobs. The total of the direct and indirect job opportunities that will be created over the next 7 years is approximately 540,000, according to the model that Transnet has developed. And through the growth program, procurement spend will be leveraged to increase localization and therefore maximize local job creation. In addition to the direct and indirect jobs, the 540,000 direct and indirect jobs, it also expected that another 480,000 opportunities will be increased through Transnet spend. In terms of skills development, Transnet will spend an average of approximately 1 billion rand per annum on training over the next 7 year MGS period. In total, Transnet would have trained over 3,000 artisans and 1,600 educators over the same period. And this graph just gives a breakdown of the key performance indicators for various skills that are required. For the localization and supplier development outcomes from the competitive supplier development program, this program entails also the development of the supply chain of Transnet such that it makes it much more easier, much more cheaper for Transnet and its supplier base to actually be able to deliver on the NDS program. If we go through the contracts that have been finalized using the ESGP program and the benefits that come out of that program, we've just provided a list of those contracts which have already been initiated within the SDP program, and these are the 100 GE locomotives, the 95 ESR locomotives, the internal and external auditor watch, the locomotive doors, pipework windows and windscreen, the fleet contract and the fuel contract. Now, through these contracts, Transnet is
promoting and encouraging the objective of localization and industrialization. So each and every contract would have an element that contributes to the development of localization. So the column on your right will actually show the level to which these elements have been built into the various contracts. So far, through all of these contracts, Transnet has been able to achieve the 37% localization, for instance, with the GE locomotive, 65% localization with the MT5 locomotives. The audit contract has been able to achieve 23% in job creation, 15% of skill development, 7% small business creation, 4% rural integration, and so on. So each and every year, these elements actually improve from a zero base to number that is increasing on an annual basis. Transnet has also recently awarded a 50 billion contract for the building of 10 64 locomotives to 4 local original OEMs, original equipment manufacturers, and these are CSR Peugeot Electric locomotives and Bombardier Transportation South Africa for the supply of 599 electric locomotives, as well as General Electric South Africa and CNR Rolling Stock South Africa for the 465 diesel locomotives. The award of this contract has got as well stringent local content, skills development and training commitments as dictated by the supplier development program. And the OEMs have complied with, and in some instances, exceeded the minimum local content criteria for a list of 60% for electric locomotives and 55% for diesel locomotives. I'll hand over to my colleague to go through the next forward.
Thank you so much, sir. If I can take you through the FOM part of the presentation, and in the outline we'll just look at skills development, job creation, industrialization, looking in particular at the project of NDP and Kukia specifically. In terms of where ESCOM is placed in terms of the program, what informs the ESCOM's program is that in MTSF, there's a target set of improving the reserve market to 19% by 2019, even though these projects started before the current MTSF, so they were covered in the previous MTSF. And they also contribute to the target of 25% investment, 25% of GDP investment by 2019. And then ESCOM also participates in Ship 9 and 10, which talks to new generation and investment in transition and distribution infrastructure. So ESCOM, through the BOL program, ESCOM has accelerated the impact of supply development and localization through the BOL program. Through localization, industrialization, skills development, and job creation. Now, I think the ESCOM presentation will be slightly different from what you've seen in the Transnet one, because the Transnet presentation was more forward-looking in terms of the plans. The ESCOM presentation is more of an account of how the BOL program has unfolded and some of the achievements that have been achieved in as far as supply development and localization is concerned. So it's in that context that the ESCOM presentation is structured. Supply development role is to increase the capacity of local suppliers for ESCOM to be able to source competitively from local markets in the across its value chain and in business to ensure that ESCOM can get competitive and fair pricing in terms of various programs. So the strategic imperative is to create an enabling environment for new suppliers, and this is done by identifying priority and high-impact commodities that are currently not available in South Africa, and creating an enabling environment to ensure that suppliers in South Africa can be developed to be able to participate in those markets. Secondly, to develop and grow existing suppliers, so the suppliers that have been working with the business over a period of time to show that they can grow and grow new capabilities to be able to do more within the business, and that they can grow and improve their sustainability. And to also grow emerging suppliers into a more larger and more medium outside businesses to be able to participate in the BIMA projects, because some of the suppliers might not have been in the supply chain for a period of years, but they don't grow and they don't mature into more medium, larger size entities. And how this is achieved is by creating clear linkages between where the bulk of money is spent and the high impact areas to ensure that there is maximum benefit for local suppliers by understanding the various suppliers. So it really requires a level of understanding and undertaking in terms of understanding the type of suppliers that you have in the business. And to establish strategic partnerships both with local and international suppliers to ensure that through whatever programs that ESCOM is involved in, at the end of the program, we are able to have a larger supplier base, or at least a larger skill base that can be utilized going forward, with the understanding that these are more long-term businesses and most of the business that you see is very effective. In terms of the BOLD program, so far contracts to the value of 106 billion have been awarded, and those total local percent committed by suppliers in ESCOM amounts to about 66%, which is 100 billion. It's at the end of December 2014, the cumulative local content spend was at 78 billion rand, and an amount of 43 billion rand has been committed for subcontracting and empowerment of large black suppliers, black women-owned, small and medium enterprises. And you can see a breakdown of the different areas between Pikusile, Ingula, and the other key projects that ESCOM has in terms of what they have spent to date. In terms of skills development, at the end of the second quarter, a total of 9,689 people were identified to be trained, and then at the end of December, the target was exceeded at 9,900, and a total of 2,277 learners were currently being trained. And I think the principle we've always adopted with the state and companies is that they do train for their own needs, but they also train in general for the South African market. To make sure that we can create a pool of talent and skills for the country and across. In terms of job creation, the ESCOM is committed to contributing to government's new growth path and new development plan and the skills support in terms of creating jobs and developing skills and boosting the local economy. And you can see we sampled some of the numbers in terms of what was in ESCOM's 4-year plan. And in terms of the actual numbers that we targeted in the numbers and the actual that was achieved. So as at the end of December 2014, a total of 24,251 jobs were created by ESCOM and its suppliers at Midikisile and in Gula. Commitment to industrialization. ESCOM has had a significant impact in local development as a result of the build program through the cooperative supplier development program, which encompasses the suppliers actually making a commitment to invest locally. since the inception of the cooperative supplier development program in 2008, ESCOM suppliers, as broken down on the left hand side column on page 24, the total supplier commitment is sitting at 1.1 billion rand, which is 82% of the committed value to the end of the project. So you can see some large suppliers, Hitachi, Alstom, and Siemens, in terms of the total investment amounts that they have committed. So these commitments that at the end of the program they should be seeing the core benefits. That have been just targeted that needs to be achieved at the end of each one of these projects. The slide on page 25 shows you some of the projects and some of the joint ventures that have been committed and that have been invested by the various suppliers. I won't go through it the line, but it varies from infrastructure investments. Some of ESCOM suppliers, Edaro and ESCOM Bank, investing 180 million rand to develop the roads in Lephalale. I think if you've been to Lephalale ages ago, and if you go there, you'll see the significant differences in terms of the infrastructure development in the area and what has been achieved. The investment in health facilities and education facilities that has been achieved through joint partnering between the various suppliers and ESCOM. Now, from the next slide, which is 25 to 27, shows the breakdown of some of the projects in detail, and I will not run through them the line, but it shows you the different projects that were achieved for MIDC and for Chile in terms of the various suppliers, the joint ventures that were created, the number of jobs that were created through that process, and the number of skills and people that were targeted for various things. The next slide after that talks to the programs at MIDC, which are focused on trying to look into the more high impact sort of development. So looking at engineering, at creating ventures between smaller suppliers with large suppliers to be able to develop engineering capability that can be employed at the project at the end when the station becomes functional at the end of the program. Kusile took a decision to prioritize education on the CSI list, and you can see the number of schools that they have invested in to ensure that there is benefit in the communities in which they operate, and to ensure that they also have, they enjoy the support of local communities in terms of developing the programs, because we have seen at the inception of the build programs that one of the drivers for labor and race was the fact that local people were actually not benefiting from the project that are in their own areas. So a lot of investment has gone into ensuring that there is local benefit for people within the communities in which these projects are taking place. In terms of the specific Hitachi program, some of these slides on the pages is page 30. An amount of 1.6 billion has been committed to invest in the know-how and transfer of knowledge, technology transfer, to ensure that at the end of the program there is local capability to be able to maintain the Kusile boilers within the borders of South Africa. So it talks about the capability to manufacture the boiler pressure parts, the steel manufacturing facility which is being created in Whitefield, which is the east of Johannesburg. The construction of a ducting and bunker workshop, which will be at Ijipi and will be shared between the various sites. Rating equipment, making sure that there are local capability to be able to provide these services, which we know will be utilized on an ongoing basis within the power plant. And to also make sure that, you know, at the completion of the project, Eskom is in a position to be able to have a wider supply of resources from, unless we tie down to long-term OEM contracts that we cannot leverage because we don't own certain capabilities and technology. The last page looks at the Siemens partnership, the FEC college that they have created in the Limpopo at the value of 20 million rand. The power academy that they've now put up in Witbank, MLSM, and the CGM production land that they have used, and that most of the equipment that came from that plant are now being used at Ingula Power Station. And also just shows you the leverage that can be achieved through the build program to ensure that, you know, local capability is improved, and that, you know, the subsequent projects from now will be able to have greater benefits for the South African economy than to have an imbalance of accounts where we have to import most of the material that is utilized at these projects. Thank you. Sure.
Change the chair.
She's very nice.
I'm now very nice. Yes. Very proud.
But I don't see the ring on your finger.
No, because the ring came off.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for the presentations, and thank you also for sending them timely, because it's really nice to be able to go through them at times, so thank you to the department for that. I just have a few questions. One of my questions is a concern, my question was TransNet. Where are we with the build of the pipeline from Richards Bay coming through to Johannesburg? Because we get various questions about that, and we remain deeply concerned at time constraints and things like that. So if you just give us an update on how that's going. And then going directly to Eskom, I think from the tip of everyone's tongue, so that's why focus is always placed highly on Eskom at the moment. In terms of skills development and job creation, a statement was made recently that just over 1,800 engineers were going to be let loose based on race. Now, obviously, this is highly problematic because we don't want to see skilled labour be lost simply because of skin colour, and also we are trained engineers who could have sort of passed on skills. So I would just like to know, with the job creation program that you have in place at the moment, is this completely race-based, gender-based? What kind of job creation are we looking at, considering this particular grouping of people that were, for lack of a better word, fired, were fired because they were white? So I'd just like an answer on that piece. And then also, when we come to suppliers, I've always wondered that a company the size of Eskom, why do we use so many middlemen? Why don't we go directly to source? And with this, I use the example of a recent story that broke in the media regarding the sourcing of diesel. And I think it was highly unfair that two people got labeled a beautician and something else, because it doesn't matter what you are, it matters what service you provide. But what I want to know is, why do we even need a middleman? Because Eskom is a big enough company to go directly to source, and we, I say we, Eskom buys in bulk and should be getting discounts from supply. And I understand that we want to create jobs, etc., but not at the expense of an already financially cash-stripped organization. And I want to know why we don't go to PetroSA or whoever we buy people from directly, thus avoiding the middleman scenario. And then just the last thing, and then I'm going to leave it for now. When it comes to our build programs and the suppliers that we use, can you just give us back a bit of background? Because I see our suppliers Alstom, and the amount invested is 106,900,000. Now, it's my understanding that at the Madupi project, Alstom actually had to be replaced by Siemens to finish the computerization program of Madupi. So why do we continue using suppliers that have created problems for us in the past? Because certainly once bitten twice shy. So I'd just like to know why the continuation, if Siemens had to come in and finish the job as we've been told, why then Alstom is then given project development for us going forward. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Secretary, for letting me make use of my short voice. Secretary, let me first appreciate the presentation, starting from the department and the two entities. Besides to the department, the coordinating role that they play community. Thank you very much, Secretary, for making up that service. And to TransNet, Secretary, I would like to make it clear that what TransNet has been it's not very clear as to how the localization concept will really apply, for the fact that such as the expertise that exists locally and the competitiveness that is required might not be available for that particular aspect to be achieved. Is there no local supplier development program that can be introduced by good entities to ensure that there is competitiveness that emanates from the local? If I don't really have a chance to maybe appreciate the naming of the concept that government is applying, the localization, industrialization, where it does not apply, when it does not reach the poorest of the poor. So the reintroduction of the railway lines in the rural areas like your Mjanzane, like your Mtata Ray, Kingstown, and also to take off not much idea this time. And to take off and to take off the legend that is in our roof. Your M2 and R61, especially in the if I'm not referring to other provinces, there's high rate of accidents because of these huge trucks and the manner in which they actually kill the infrastructure that is built by provinces and municipalities. So it might not be part of Transnet mandate to introduce some of that aspect. But what is it that Transnet can do to ensure that they also expand and try to reach that particular aspect that does not form part of their mandate? Lastly, the salon, with ESCOM in particular, I have had a mention of the community realization program, communities being involved. But the level of that is not particularly clear. You know, now these days, we want something very specific, ESCOM. You must be upfront and say, this is what you are going to do with communities. If there is a pilot program that you are intending to implement, it must be named. It must not be a general usage of the community part being involved, when you know that our people are so hungry. They are hungry and they want to do well. How do you make sure that your electricity lines that are crossing all over the shelves in Kingstown and and Alexandra in Kaldik, how do you make sure that they are safe? How do you make sure that you can lessen the number of deaths as a result of that by utilizing the same communities to protect people or to protect themselves? How do you do that in the name of localization and creation of jobs by utilizing?
Thank you, Jason. I just want to echo the one piece of input forward on the pipeline. What is the real problem? Because to be so far behind and you couldn't take the part in this time span, I mean, there is problems that is not highlighted clearly to the community. Clearly, I want to go to page 10. I just want to clarify the question of clarity on the 60 megatons to 70 on the expansion time for the only producer of another line in this district that is to another line as well. They're the only ones you can touch on that station. Because I just want to correlate with the correspondence I received in that regard. And then the last one, I just want to check with you, see what you're planning as far as the contributions of creation, all of that. Well, keep out in the next 3-5 years, it would be interesting if we have to completely match that area here with a key plan and see how we actually achieve that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I have just two questions specifically for Johnson. I really enjoyed your presentation. It was great to see that Transnet has projected to create thousands of jobs, train thousands of people. I mean, we've tended to be great at creating great plans, but not so great implementation. So I really hope that all these plans be implemented and all these jobs created and all these jobs created. What you correctly mentioned could be a hindrance for this plan, is the infrastructure maintenance backlog for Transnet. The backlog stood at 30 billion last year. How much have you succeeded in reducing that? Can you give us figures? And then just to echo my colleague, there are too many people losing their lives on our roads because of trucks. You mentioned that Transnet is focusing on the shift from road from road to rail. Can you give us some detail about that, what a transit actually is? Thank you, Chair.
No, thanks, Chairperson. My name is Oscar. Raise some few questions in terms of the local mission and political. I can see that the mission is very on that. Maybe transmit was my forward looking presentation. But I'm quite interested to understand in terms of the reason for that 50 billion contract, which in the main is to benefit that is the local our local business. The question that I have, because I think sometimes I've come to learn that very good at presentations, and I've been saying that over and over to say sometimes they're very much glorified, and when you look into the details of the real presentations of the what Manfu has compared out of the what has been presented in practical terms, you find a total a different sort of the case in point is the one that was achieved that the department is in ESCOM. In terms of people that are actually directly benefiting here, if how are our black business owned companies, because I don't think it is very clear, because just if the company local, it may be white, it may be a black and so on. It can just be a specific customer so that we're able to understand, are we able to make the necessary intention and growth? Because we know that sometimes you put all the procedures to see the DEE kind of people that are building them as the DEE compliance and all of that. These are the details that we need so that we can be able to see that in the 50 billion contract that was awarded, there are so many people that have been that have benefited more so those that were previously organizations. Then I think the other one was partly covered through my colleague here. The other issue in the manifesto of no ruling party. It says that 6 million jobs will be created. That was the manifesto of all of that. And the presentation says that by 2020, I know that the 6 million does not really mean that it is public enterprise that it should be responsible for creating those 6 million jobs. But just the general figure that has been given by the president. I just wanted to, the president, can I not be presented? What is wrong when I'm saying the president? What is wrong about that? Yeah, but protect me also, Chairperson. Thank you. Yeah. What is it that has been able to contribute to the public enterprise in the light of what has been said? To attend 6 million jobs and all of that. Today, what is it that has been able to contribute? As we are trying to get 5 million jobs in 2020. On ESCOM, given the financial challenges and the current development, I just want to understand how is this going to affect the supply development program and the research development program, given the financial constraints that we actually ESCOM actually faced in the current. Again, on Transnet, the current program has implemented something like 4,350 people on a new multi-purpose pipeline. And obviously, what will happen once the whole program has been done? What are the exit strategies for this? Because I think that the intake is on the basis of a short-term program, which is intended to build those multi-purpose pipelines. I think those are the questions for now that I really wanted to get the response from the partner. Thanks.
I'm not sure. I would say that this is maybe some of the questions that the honorable member has raised, but I went out for 5 minutes. presentation, the presenter on industrialization and localization, page 5 of the presentation, the presenter talked about the contribution that they want to make on the aim of increasing economic growth as the MVP. My question and my concern is around the efficiency, the sufficient, and the competence to do what is expected, because we might have all the resources, but if we don't have the human resources that are enough or sufficient or sufficient and competent energy, we might not reach our goal. Do we really have those people to do what is expected of them in all our efforts as a department? We should competent people within the within our efforts. On Transnet, the 7-year period that you're speaking about on your Transnet market construction, do you include in the 7 years your recruitment, your training, and your sales development? I'm sure that every department within the first 7 years that you have aimed for or that you have targeted for, those skills that are really needed within Transnet, we will get them in the first 7 years. I know that the program is 7 years, as the presenter has said, because the first 7 years, the target that we have set for yourself is very good to happen. I also have a concern on the issue of rail transport and the transportation of the big trucks that are on the road. Do you have a relationship with the Department of Transport? Because I think that will not be on Transnet only. It will only affect the Department of Transport, or the Department of Transport must i.e. on what the Transnet wants to do in reducing the carnage on the road, and also reducing and also helping our provinces to some other roads that Honorable Nguyen has spoke about.
Chair, I think the last one was being will be on the issue of Eskom. You know, when you think about UNDP and Kosele only, and Jack spoke about the expenditure on Imbula, it's as if there are no programs that relate to the programs that are being done at UNDP and Kosele. If you are not speaking anything about the Imbula, why did you say on your presentation you'll be only focusing on the two? Because I think Imbula has also had an impact on the community around that program, and also it has an impact in terms of your targeted goals that you have. You just spoke about the two, and it looks like you don't want to say anything about England. The Eskom establishment of the Olivan Street primary school that was made by the government. In the presentation, you mentioned the millions that you have used in infrastructure development and everything, and you mentioned the places, but in this infrastructure school, you did not mention how much the amount attached to the refurbishment of the school. I'm not sure if it was just a misprint or maybe you forgot the amount that you have put in that program. Thank you, sir.
I want to check if this is with the employer, the shareholder. What is about the employer, the industry, about the shareholder?
Where are you?
On the phone number. I don't know what it says. When you come on the audience, you can have a break on the page. They haven't spoke about the infrastructure center, and then they talk about the intervention. So we just want to have an understanding of what are they doing.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think first, before we answer the questions, if I could just clarify that we are actually officials of the Department of Public Enterprise. We are not officials of the SEC, but we oversee the SEC.
What is this explanation for?
The comment was thanks the presentation from the department, and then the honourable member said to us as a representative.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes. Please, Sir President, can you please bring? But I don't remember myself being so confused in regards.
Sorry.
It can't.
Some person.
And the answer is probably
we are expecting the department to answer because you are overseeing the FDA.
That's obvious to the question. That's why they speak on behalf of the state-owned companies. They present it on state-owned companies. My assumption is that the DR, they have well conversant with the developments that are taking place in the state-owned companies. It is them that are presenting. At this point in time, it is them that are presenting on behalf of the state-owned. Somebody, I think, the DG said that whatever the D, the DG from Transnet,
no,
the DG from Transnet and ESCO.
Oh,
that's what she said.
Okay. Thank you. Just starting with the question about the pipeline from Richard Bay to, is it Johannesburg or Johannesburg?
Well, both actually.
Okay.
Let's talk about both.
Okay. The one from the Kunda is actually still in feasibility phase, and then Transnet is also awaiting the master plan, the gas master plan from the Department of Energy.
Is that GAM?
So, sorry.
Yes. Yeah, GAM, the gas utilization of Hila.
So that's where Transnet is at with regard to that.
Okay.
The Joburg Richards Bay one, I don't have the details for that. I could find
it. That for me. Okay.
I could do that. Okay, and then with regard to how localization is applied, and the fact that there is no local supplier development program, actually there is. It refers to the competitive supplier development program. It includes all the elements, of localization in the surrounding zone. So basically,
yes. Of course, the terms of presenters when they, I know they are asking specific questions to specific people. Can they answer to you and be so that we all can hear? Because if you're speaking to that person, to the face of that person, they are unable to hear because of these things that are not working. So
So with regard to the question about localization, how it is applied in the comments that there is no local supply development program, the response there is that there is a supply development program which is called the competitive supply development program. And how that is applied really is that for each and every contract that is awarded, if, for instance, the major contractor is a foreign company, there will always be a partnering with local suppliers. That is a requirement of all of the contracts that are awarded, because we want to promote the objective of localization. So within that program, within the contract, there would also be a commitment made that Transnet, for instance, would expect the contractors to make, and these are included in the contract, that, for instance, there would be training of the local suppliers, there would be the partnering, and there would be skills development, there would be skills transfer, and so on. So, because if the contracts do not take into account those elements of localization and industrialization. And from a department's perspective, we actually track development through the shareholder contract. So there would be targets that are set for Transnet at the beginning of every financial year that Transnet would have to meet overall in its business with regard to those localization and industrialization objectives. And then with regard to the development of the railways in support of the road to rail initiative, I think that it would be helpful, like, I think, to just sketch the structure of how the network is actually managed between the different rail operators. So Transnet, while it is responsible for the railway infrastructure that carries freight Transnet is responsible for the network that is passenger. So some of the lines would be in the passenger network. The Nkata line, for instance, that the Honourable Member mentioned, is a line that has predominantly been carrying passenger services, but it has been owned by Transnet Freight in the past, because in the past it carried both freight and passengers. But because that business died off, the only, I guess, feasible services that could be offered were passengers. Although those, even the passenger numbers were not enough to ensure that the line is operated sustainably in the long term. And it was leased in the past years to the Eastern Cape government. There was a contractor who was contracted to the Eastern Cape government to actually run that line, and unfortunately the services couldn't continue because they would have not been. So what happens is that in cases where there are lines in certain areas that are not used, there will always be a reason why that line is not being used, and it is mainly always because the services are not feasible. However, even as it may, Transnet has identified, and most of these lines are in the branch lines network, which are mainly in the rural areas. So Transnet has come up with a strategy that is meant to introduce private sector operators into those lines. Why? Because it may actually be much more efficient, much more feasible if they are operated by the private sector. Because at the scale that they would operate, they could probably, I'm not sure, I'm not saying that it is certain, they could probably be able to carry out those operations sustainably. Because the models that the private sector uses would be different from the models that the people in company Transnet uses. So that strategy is currently in implementation phase. You probably have seen that there has been a request that was put out to the public to respond to an invitation to bid on the operation of branch lines. So that is currently underway. What are the problems with the NMPP, and when is this project going to be finalized? It is envisaged that it would be finalized in the 2018 financial year. The reason why we have...
Are you saying we are outsourcing the building of the lines to the private sector?
No. We are outsourcing the operation of those lines to the private sector. Those lines that Transnet is currently not operating, or... well, some of it Transnet is operating, some of it Transnet is not operating. But to promote the private sector participation objective, these lines are being offered to the private sector for them to operate. And these are lines that Transnet in the past has not been able to operate efficiently due to their business model. You find that the business model is not in line with the hub-to-hub type of operation that Transnet operates. And as a result, they have become unprofitable and lost traffic to roads. Coming back to the delays on the NMPP, there are various reasons that have contributed to the delay of the NMPP. Firstly, the NMPP was supposed to be built on particular specifications, particular dimensions, which called for a narrower pipeline. But then the government decided that we actually needed a wider one, which initially obviously delayed the build of the pipeline. And then adding to that, I think we will all appreciate that for a very long time in South Africa we have not invested in such mega projects. So there would be teething problems here and there when we engage in these mega projects. So some of the delays were attributed on the NMPP to design problems engineering and managing problems. And as a result of that, Transnet then had to change the company that was contracted with the engineering and management of this particular contract, and hence the delay. So those are the two major factors that contributed to the delay on the NFET project. I'm sorry, I didn't quite get the question on CIPI.
Clarity on the
It is on the Saldana channel. How much have we covered in terms of infrastructure backlog? In the past year, we Transnet has invested about 18.5 billion of the 31 billion in maintenance. And with regards to road to rail initiatives, what is Transnet doing in that regard? Part of this build program is actually meant to alleviate the great traffic that is being moved currently on roads. But I think it is also good to just indicate that not all traffic that is moving on roads is actually rail friendly. So some of the traffic will still remain on the road. And in addition to that, certain distances are not economic to be operated by the railway. So those will always remain in the road, in our roads. The question is, how do we then ensure a government that the road services are operated in a safe manner and the accidents are reduced? And that is something that the DOT is responsible for. Unfortunately, I'm not qualified to answer that question. However, on the Transnet side, making sure that we invest in the infrastructure to ensure that there is enough capacity to carry that spillage that has gone to the road, and in improving on our efficiency will ensure that eventually the move from road to rail is actually realized. Who benefits from the 50 billion rand local contract? We have already mentioned the four companies that have been able to secure those contracts. And as indicated before, these major contractors do subcontract with local suppliers. So each and every contract has an element of local suppliers in it, and also that element of training, skills development, and so on. So I think we all appreciate the fact that we would be at different levels of development with regard to our manufacturing capabilities because of the levels of skill that we have in the country. So whereas, as an example, one company may be able to provide steel that is required to manufacture traction motors, for instance, we may not have the full capability and capacity as a country to manufacture the traction motors. But what we are looking to do is that through the partnership between the foreign companies and the local suppliers, the commitments that we expect or that we require the foreign companies to do in terms of skills transfers, training, development of the local suppliers and so on, should ensure that we move, and as well as the training that is done in the country, which the government supports through the teachers and so on, will bring our people to the level that is required in time. And it's not going to happen in a very short space of time. But we are anticipating that in the long term, as a country, we will be able to build our capabilities to an extent where we are able to build those full components for the locomotives. And we not only are able to assemble, but we are able to produce our own locomotives ourselves. So that's what we have committed Transnet to ensure that it develops those capabilities. And in fact, Transnet Engineering has actually started that initiative to ensure that they do the research and development that is required to get us here. Also, South Africa has been in the AU, within the AU, South Africa has been appointed to champion the manufacturing of locomotives for the continent. So we should be seeing great improvements in that regard. With regard to the recruitment, training, and skills development, the target for the 7th year, has it really happened? Yes, it has happened. In the 7-year rolling program, what we do as a department is that for each and every year that we start, each and every financial year that we start, we sign a shareholder contract with the SOCs, and we put in targets in terms of training, skill development, and so on. So each and every year, or at least at the end of every year, we assess whether these targets have been reached or not. And in Transnet's regard, the targets have always been reached, and in some cases they have been exceeded. I think the relationship with the DOT in reducing the tonnages of the I've responded to that one as well. I hope I've responded to all of the questions with regard to Transnet. I'll hand over to my colleague.
Thanks, Mosha. The DG has to step out, so we have wanted to take on a few questions. So we'll come back to them. If I can respond to the first question that was asked about the impact of ESCOM financial constraints on supplier development in some of these programs. I think the challenges that ESCOM faces do place pressure on ESCOM and some of the programs that it needs to execute. And one of the measures, as you may remember, when the cabinet decision was made in terms of finding levers to close the funding gap, was that ESCOM needs to find efficiencies within its business and within some of the contacts that it has. And that in itself sets a tone for ESCOM in terms of how they need to be dealing with various suppliers and ensuring that they get greater value. So it places constraints in terms of its ability to spend on additional programs, and also places pressure in terms of existing contracts and existing programs that they have been committed to, that they have to go back and negotiate for every single rent that they are committing to. So it would have an impact in terms of, you know, programs that were not already committed to, that they might have to defer to a later time to ensure that they can execute programs that are already committed. There was a question around sufficiency and competence to execute programs. I think it remains a challenge, and linking back to the question around investment backup, is that, you know, there is a lot of catch-up that we are trying to do in terms of investment. And I think, in particular, the ESCOM environment, the construction of both Mdupi, Kushile, Imbula, and all the other projects simultaneously places a large, huge pressure on the South African market, on the ESCOM environment itself, to be able to execute. So there is constraints that remain. However, there is measures in place to try and intervene to ensure that, you know, we can create capability for both from a construction perspective and contract engineering perspective to be able to execute those contracts. The issues in Gula, I did not cover in Gula. I think it was simply because, you know, if you look at the spend, I think it was a slide 21, I focus on the larger spend, which is about 130 billion out of 155, and it was simply from that perspective that we focused on that. But there certainly are benefits that have been derived from other projects, from Igula. I think, you know, the pictorial depiction of the site always tells us, so if you look at the site from, you know, 5-7 years ago to where they are today, you can see the clear benefits for those areas. And I think the same would apply for the Sarah wind farm. The spend on Olifant Primary, we're quite happy to provide the details if they are required. There wasn't a specific reason why that specific detail was provided. and is the department making sure that spend on IT industry is achieved, in particular for MVP. I think if you look at some of the projects that are put in here, they're not all engineering related and also specific to the build. And there is expansion that does go into secondary markets that become created because of the project. We can make details available if that is required. Gee, I don't know if you want us to issue a visa or something to that, but we can
go for the
okay. Just in terms of the question that was asked around diesel and why we have the middlemen that are used to source certain commodities, in particular it was diesel that was requested. I think the philosophy is that Eskom does have suppliers that it has long-term relationships with, but with the current environment and the shortfall in terms of energy and having to supplement and run the diesel plant more than they were originally planned for, as a result of having Eskom to go into the spot market to procure this and having to go on an open process to try and procure these services. So I think that this is not a long-standing arrangement that has been placed. It was because Eskom had to go into the spot market to procure. And I think, you know, if you're going to negotiate when you find yourself in a position that Eskom is in, I think they find themselves having to commit to procuring in the spot market to be able to supplement the long-term contracts that exist.
Thank you, Chair, the committee member, and apologies for stepping out in the middle of the engagement. It's just needed to attend to one emergency in the office. I think maybe let me start where my colleague Makhola has ended. One of the key lessons learned, and it's something that we've been working on, is state-owned companies collaboration, and sometimes we call it the public-public partnerships. The issue of the diesel in Eskom also made us realize that you need to introduce different mechanisms how state-owned companies relate to one another. We intervened at the department and also through the war room to ensure that Eskom concludes a memorandum of agreement with the PetroSA and the Strategic Fuel Fund and Transnet, and to just make sure that we facilitate the reliable supply of diesel, but also to make sure that we begin to get into understanding the procurement and purchasing philosophy behind that. And I think by now members are aware that part of the investigation that the Eskom board has initiated is to look also into the details of those kind of contracting mechanisms. And I think with that we will be able then going forward to understand the kind of contractual mechanisms and also to be able to see how we sharpen the engagement between Eskom and all its suppliers, whether being public or private. Because also at the same time, we don't want the situation whereby you're crowding out the private sector by showing that it's only a relationship between the state-owned companies. So it's again the issue of striking a healthy balance between Eskom and business, as well as the government requirements. I think that on the issue of NMPP and the delays, and why we thought initially when we were supposed to do this presentation that we wanted to share with the committee from the perspective of the department, not only as a build, was that with the work that we've done, there are common trends and features that are coming out in terms of the build program, whether you can look at those that we're inviting upon at home or globally. And one of the things that both colleagues have spoken about in terms of lack of investment and the impact thereof, because at a time when government made the decision that state-owned companies, your Eskoms, your Transnet, they should not invest, because at that time the drive was around privatization, the skill that was lost made it difficult that at the time when a decision was taken for those companies now to engage in the massive build program, then the challenge was you played heads up not only in terms of we needed to be able to address a particular problem that is facing the country, but also now that sourcing those kind of skills hence the reliance on OEMs because we didn't have those skills locally. We lost it at the time when some of the big and massive build programs internationally, they lost that skill. So, and another trend that is coming out is the project scope. Koto spoke about a division to when you start your construction to or your plan at your planning phase, the division is that you're going to construct a 12-inch pipeline and mix the change, you know, we want a 24-inch pipeline. A division like that as well affects then the planning and the problems of the impact of that division are realized later on as and when the project is constructed. And of course there's issues around planning, execution, monitoring of projects as well. And I think part of the work that we've been doing with the state-owned companies is capacitating not only the state-owned companies in those areas, but also capacitating ourselves for our shareholders for oversight. So I think the lesson from the current bill, and NMPP, LACIN, MITUPIC, and all of those, are saying to us we should make sure that we don't repeat those mistakes by making sure that with the pipeline in terms of skills development is concerned. And even the day when we would have sufficient electricity supply in the country, I think we should continue. Hence the CSDP is there to ensure that you train, and as Mahola said, not only for yourself, but for the country as a whole. So I thought that is important also to sketch the background in terms of we've been looking at these delays and all the challenges around the bill to make sure that as we construct in the future, we put some kind of mechanisms to make sure that we don't repeat the same thing. Not that we're saying there may not be challenges in the future, but we're saying the extent thereof should be well managed. The question around, and I don't know if Mahola this topic, in my appearance, why do you continue using suppliers that have been a challenge in the past? I think by now also committee members will be aware that one of the challenges in the build program is the owner contracting. And again, it's linked to the whole issue of skills, that at the time when you embark on mega projects and the skills that you've lost, not only a technical or engineering skills, but also skills in terms of now how do you package your contracts, how do you negotiate for reopeners to make sure that the owner of closure of the contracts will be addressed in the event that there are disputes. So we as a department, there were times where we insisted that to ESCOM that now you engaged with the suppliers, you engaged with the OEMs to a point whereby we want you to trigger your rights in terms of this contract. And you are aware that now at some point ESCOM went to court to go and enforce its rights in terms of penalty clauses and insurance clauses. And they were able to be successful in those. So we continue engaging with those OEMs because we do have contracts with them, and those are long-term contracts. However, we've also been very able to engage in terms of the owner's provisions of those contracts, how do we engage in reopeners with those OEMs. I think the last issue that I wanted to touch on was around the again, it's still linked to the issue of skills development and job creation. The question around the 1,800 employees that were reported in the media that they would be lost or missed or retrained. What we have subsequently done through the War Room and through the department as well was to engage ESCOM on not only a particular aspect of the build program, but to say to look at ESCOM in the current circumstances and the challenges that are facing the country and the company, there must be a plan of looking at headcount. Mm-hmm. So it's not only to address it in respect of your finances, that you would release so many employees and then you would be saving so much in terms of your salary cost or employee cost. But it's more around use those employees, what kind of skill are you going to be using? Because then you may find that you go back and try to get the skill in the private sector or in the market at the higher cost. So with those discussions in mind, ESCOM suspends the process of looking at the issue of the headcount and the retrenchment of the VSP. So the report that we also received from ESCOM is that it's not true that it is going ahead.
Mm.
But it's also part of the engagement with the department in terms of now looking at the future plan for the company, but only from the financial aspect of what we can do in terms of the retrenchment. So here, I thought it was just the areas that I wanted to discuss.
Any other questions?
Thank you so much. Firstly, let me start with the follow-up question on the two questions that I've asked to both Transnet and ESCOM. The one to ESCOM relates to the physical services. No, it's Transnet. The physical services with regards to the Tata lines. And then you are suggesting that the private sector should be afford, which they appreciate. Do you have any means of assistance that you will come up with in the form of maybe a grant maybe from the department with regard to financially empower the business people that would want to be part of this exercise, because it is very important. A similar kind of question to, with regards to the business model that is abided by companies, which is not to be feasible enough for the move from the railway line, from the roads that are actually damaged by the overhead, by the heavy duty truck. Then is there any means that you would employ to also empower the business sector to also come on board? Because the public-private partnership is very important if there is any kind of assistance for businesses and individual members of the public may not be able to rise to the financial standards to be on board. Lastly, with regard to the new question, with regard to appropriate technology and digital knowledge to ESCOM regarding the productivity of how best can you assist communities to use their indigenous means to produce power. Thank you.
There's a question before she looked at the number. It's about 4,000 and multiple tools and pipeline. What is going to be the basic strategy once that product is reached the final issue? The second issue, the question that I've answered is I understand the explanation in terms of the EU compliant and all of that. But in an event that we can't get the required things, we always rely on the foreign companies to actually be such things if we don't have. Maybe I didn't actually clarify myself. The point that I was actually making, because I was quite specific to say that how many black people and the experience is that the benefit that they are actually getting is only on very small scale survey issues. But on the strategic part of the whole project in terms of the economic empowerment, it's something that we normally see that we don't have required questions. But later you find that it's something that our own people, something that they could be able to do. And that's what I was understanding, that it can be clarified with regard to that. I take into the consideration that the BEE part of it will be able to be quite explicit with regard to the issue of the empowerment, particularly, but I would have thought that the department, the thought putting, it's important sometimes, like as you said, that the chapter that we hold in and see that these are so many black people in terms of the strategic part of the contract where they are able to benefit. That's what I was expecting from the department. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, just to get a bit of clarity, so we have absolute confirmation from ESCOM that those 1,800 jobs, that it was incorrect reporting and that these people will not be losing their jobs based on race. So just so that we have that firmly confirmation, please, because it's something that we are questioned on a daily basis by concerned ESCOM employees. And then secondly, Chair, I may have missed it, but I didn't hear the explanation regarding Ulster and Siemens, and why we continue to use the companies that have proven to be ineffective in the past. I don't think that question was sufficiently answered, because I certainly didn't hear a fair enough explanation, especially considering the cost that we incurred at Medici because of this.
Any other questions
regarding
the
numbers?
If not, can I also raise another concern in relation to identity of the challenge? We were told we have a dashboard where all the employees report and we are able to monitor from there. Now, were you not able to pick up at whatever stage this cash flow problem and also contracts which have been paid huge amount of money, in particular in data, and not being able to rely on time to see where we are going to have a cash in relation to cash flow management, and again we just want to be clarified on issues of the contract related to SR. We are being told we are being paying them for the whole we are going to do. Look at the guarantee to be present in the
okay. Thank you, Chairperson. The question about grants for these lines that are not feasible to operate by Transnet. This is really a policy decision the government has to take. If I could give a little bit of background to come to a response on that. Transnet at some point identified these branch lines for private sector participation, mainly because of the fact that in Eastern Rand strategy, Transnet had taken a decision to focus on those services that it considered to be core. So branch lines had been identified as non-core at the time, during the turnaround. And mainly because, like I have said, they had lost a lot of traffic to road. They were unprofitable. There had been great backlog maintenance on the line. So they had been identified either to be closed or outsourced to the private sector or whatever alternatives there would have been to keep them running. But it was not the intention of Transnet to continue operating those because of their locative nature and the activities that had reduced. However, throughout the discussions with the DOT and the DPE, it was decided actually that Transnet should continue operating these lines, irrespective of the fact that they are not making, purely because they also serve as feeder lines into the main network, which Transnet considers to be core. But then the question came, as you are aware that, you know, the SOCs are actually required to make a profit so that they're able to reinvest into the business and so on. So the question was, what does Transnet then do with those branch lines? Do they keep on operating them if they're not profit-making? How do they actually fund their infrastructure and continued operation? And this is where the issue of private sector participation came in. But the question remains, who funds that gap? And if you look at how other countries actually manage these types of services, which are always considered to be socio-economic, or rather to be playing a socio-economic role in the economy of the different countries, most governments actually fund this operation, whether they do that through a grant or through a subsidy. But currently, we don't have a policy that supports, at national level, we don't have a policy that supports that kind of funding mechanism for the loss-making operations of the SAC. So it has been an issue that has been left really without a policy. It is an issue that has been left entirely to Transnet to see what they can do with those grants. So in that respect, what Transnet has come up with as a strategy is that for those lines that could be suitable for operation by the private sector, the private sector will indicate their interest to operate them, and Transnet has been putting some funds, some investments into those lines to keep them at a fit the proposed level for operating. So whereas they had not been invested in before, Transnet keeps on investing in them. And that is the contribution that Transnet is making to sort of meet the private sector halfway. So instead of them giving a grant to the private sector, they keep on maintaining the line. And when it happens that private sector, for instance, is able to secure a contract to operate a particular branch, there will be risks shared between private sector and Transnet. Transnet, or let me rather say, government will continue to own the infrastructure, the infrastructure. It will not be given over to the private sector. However, through those long-term contracts, those concessions, the private sector would be responsible to ensure that the infrastructure is maintained, with Transnet having played that funding role, or that rather that maintenance role, to keep the lines up to a safety operating status. I hope that answers the question. Strategic roles for black people. When these contracts are actually put out to the public for them to bid on the contracts, the readiness of the black companies will determine the role that they take in those contracts. So Transnet does not determine that black suppliers will play the role in this particular contract. So when a contract is put out there, let's say for instance for wheels, if there is a black company out there that is able to produce those wheels, they will bid. You know, and this is how the determination will come as to how strategic black people, or rather the strategic role that black people play in this contract. So it depends on the level of capability and capacity that we have from our people. And then if I could take an opportunity to come back to you, ma'am, on the through you, Sir President, on the question around the Richards Bay pipeline. The Richards Bay to Joburg pipeline, as I indicated before, is in feasibility stage. The Richards Bay second one is currently operational. Yes, so that's one. There isn't really any.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. The question around how can Eskom assist communities in terms of other technologies that are available that they can utilize for own generation and to be able to alleviate the current energy shortfall. I think the procurement of additional energy from market remains the ambit of the Minister of Energy.
However, there has been a lot of proposals that we have been receiving over the last few months since we started ESCOM started load shedding again. And there was an expression of interest also that was run through the Department of Energy just to get a sense of what are these technologies that are available and where they are placed within the integrated resource plan and whether they are fit for purpose in terms of the current shortfall, and they are being assessed through by the Department of Energy and they will go into a procurement process. But if there are other options that have not been captured through that process, they can be submitted to the Department of Energy for assessment and feasibility to see, you know, if these are, because even though we do have a shortfall, we still have to do an assessment of, you know, where in the energy shortfall they fall, like these mid-merits, these base load kind of options that are being put on the table, and they have to be assessed in terms of a merit order and affordability against other options that are available. So I think my best advice would be to say that the proposals would then have to be forwarded to the Minister of Energy for their consideration. In terms of ASCOM versus Siemens, I think to try and provide further clarity, I think the first thing is that ASCOM doesn't just only do the C&I work at NDP and Bushile, they also do the turbine center line and it's two separate packages that they have. So from that perspective, the center line contract is separate and still in place, and they have been performing on that front. In terms of the C&I, as the DD was saying earlier on, you know, it is an onerous process that you have to go through in terms of getting to a point where you do a factory acceptance test, where you can decide to reject the system and actually then pursue other options in the contract to be able to proceed. So in terms of Unit 6, Siemens was appointed to take over a contract, but for the other units, they have to go through a process where we have to get to a certain process in the engineering process in terms of accepting and testing the system and having the system fail before you can exit the process. But as the DG said, you know, it goes back to the ability to conduct an onerous process that actually turn out to work more in favor of suppliers than they do specifically for the MDP contract, and that, you know, ESCOM has to honor those processes to try and minimize risk of litigation going forward, which would then attract additional costs to the project. In terms of the coal from Exaro, I assume you refer to the coal from Idupi, from the Huotel mine. It would be correct.
It would be lots of luck.
Huh?
And lots of happiness.
If I can proceed, it would be correct to say that the Exaro contract was running ahead of schedule in terms of deliveries based versus the MDP unit 6 burn and when the unit was supposed to be unloaded. So Exaro was ready to deliver coal and MDP unit 6 was still running behind schedule, but the type of contract arrangement that they had was take or pay, and therefore ESCOM had to pay penalties in terms of the coal that they could not receive because, you know, the facilities were not ready and the unit was not ready to burn the coal that Exaro would have provided. So it is correct, the report that you may have seen. In terms of monitoring mechanisms, why didn't we pick up the issue of cash flow? I think ESCOM's financial woes, we go back to as far as 2012, and we have been away from the time that the regulator made a decision around ESCOM's cash level, which was based on certain assumptions around how ESCOM's operations would perform, how certain costs would grow in the business, and subsequent to that, you know, a lot of that changed. The operating regime was different from what was in the decision, besides the fact that the decision itself afforded ESCOM half of the tariff that ESCOM had applied for. And in addition, then ESCOM went into a mode of burning a lot more cash through the OCGT due to the levels of availability of the plant, and the department did work closely with ESCOM and the National Treasury and the Department of Energy to try and drive an appropriate response plan to be able to deal with the funding shortfall. I think the reality is that, you know, there's a lot of moving parts in terms of the ESCOM environment, and we find ourselves having to continuously monitor and find appropriate ways to intervene and to be able to provide requisite support to ensure that the MQ remains a going concern. The challenges, I think, remain over the MIPD3 period, However, we are monitoring and ensuring that the support that the cabinet approved last year is implemented fully, but also being aware that, you know, a number of things would have changed, you know, the additional levers that now need to be put to ensure that the energy shortfall can be closed would also require additional funding, and we therefore have to go through a process where we, on top of monitoring the implementation of the support package, ensuring that we understand what are the new developments and what are the new programs that need to be implemented to ensure that we can minimize load shedding so that we can support economic growth. In terms of, there was a question I didn't answer earlier on around ESCOM's activities and then just communities in terms of contact incidents. I don't have facts in terms of whether this area of the of incidents is declining or rising. I think, for instance, there is still an incident, you know, one incident is too many and is still receive full support. I think ESCOM does try and raise different levels of awareness. However, it does seem still to be an attractive market for people to, but most of it is linked to the theft of copper. So I think for as long as that market is very attractive and that the punitive measures that are being taken to try and deal with that specific crime are not as harsh as we believe it should be, that part remains very attractive and you see people still attempting to access ESCOM's facilities so that they can, you know, steal either scrap metals or copper and so forth. So ESCOM continues to do its part in terms of educating people and doing awareness campaigns. However, I think we need to look into doing a greater venture in terms of understanding, you know, the drivers of this behavior. And there has been touchings that have been set, one shared by the department with various parties within the justice and the security sector to try and see what legislative instruments can be used to try and see how this can be minimized. You know, because other than the injuries and the fatalities that we see, it does affect the level of service and quality of service that the communities do receive. So it's an area that continues to receive attention and we'll report on it as we progress.
If I could, Chair, there's one question that I had not answered, and that's with regard to the plan for the 4,300 jobs that have been created through the NMPP. What is going to happen moving forward? I mean, I think that it is only natural that when the contract ends, part of those jobs or those functions would end too. However, there would still be maintenance required on the NMPP. And from where I'm sitting, it's in my view that those skills are still required for the ongoing maintenance of the NMPP. And then taking into consideration again that there would be further work to do with regard to the NMPP in other areas. My personal view is that those skills would still be required, so it is possible that they could be used in other areas as well. So that's basically what I think about that. I don't have an official plan from Transnet, but what I'm saying is that naturally the project and those functions should be there.
Thank you, Chair. As I'm talking to you, the memo is getting before the economic sector and infrastructure cluster today for onward submission full cabinet by 15th of April. What I can share with you is that all the work that was supposed to have done is being done, and
the application of the remuneration standard will be not only for state-owned companies, because DTE is only but will be within the whole Schedule 2 and Schedule 3. So, the next time we have Schedule 2 and 3, and that was my recommended recommendation, that we should align and have a consistent application across Schedule 2 and Schedule 3. So, next time when we engage Chair, we'll be able then to give you feedback in terms of full implementation. We started pilot last year with the AGM. On bonuses and incentives, we will engage soon, and then we'll see some of the conditions that we put for state-owned companies where there will be no bonus. It's already that engagement with some of the state-owned companies and communicating with them that given the current performance level, there will be no incentive, but we can engage with that. The one you mean, there was the previous one that were paid. Remember, this short-term incentive, the long-term incentive. Those long-term incentives that have vested, and it's a period of 3 years, so you had to pay those. So that's why we've been saying with the remuneration standards that as of a particular day, those long-term incentives should see and communicate that this is a state-owned company and they sign off on it. But what we are paying now are those that have vested, because it's a 3 year vesting. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
We have some
thank you. The resolutions, if they are properly captured, as per our discussions and our report in that meeting. Okay.
please for the adoption, Chair?
Were you present?
Yes.
Oh,
it was there. I certainly was it.
Yeah.
I was the one asking more questions.
She has moved for the adoption. Any second?
Yes.
Thank you very much. That's been us to the end of our meeting. There are no announcements. Except the one loser. We'll meet next week when we interact with the minister. And have a lovely day. Thank you very much.